Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. I hope you're well. How are you adjusting to spring? If you can call this spring. We just got done with a snowstorm here in Minneapolis. Hit, I think, like seven states or something. Tornadoes across the south. I just got back from New York last night. One of the worst flights ever. Turbulence, like nothing I've ever experienced before. And they kept reminding us that it's going to be safe. We got about 10 more minutes of this. So I made it through. Spring is amazing when it's amazing, but the flip side is that it can be quite disorienting, like a drug that our whole system seems to crave at times. The days when the sun is shining seems to fill our hearts with lightness. Our energy surges, our steps feel light. And there's a new freedom that we feel, no longer encumbered by the masses of clothing. And then we have to put them back on again because suddenly it's 38 degrees and raining and threatening to snow. And the roller coaster can start to take its toll on us. You know, that, you know, combined with all the new stuff floating around in the air from the trees. You know, the thing about spring is that it's an environmental stew of sorts. And from a neurological perspective, a neurochemical perspective, we really are sort of riding this roller coaster. And, you know, I can have one day where I'm just feeling great, beaming and enjoying the bounty of spring's glow. And then I have a day like today where suddenly I'm feeling sluggish. I feel the heaviness. It's cloudy again. I kind of feel it in my chest. My eyelids get heavy and every footfall seems effortful. And that's really what spring looks like. So if you're having one of those days where you feel like you should be happy that it's spring and that winter is behind us, this is part of the reason you're feeling that way. So just ride it out. You're not alone. It's a common pattern. I hear it every year in my practice and experience it myself. And just remember to listen to what your body is communicating. If you're having one of those days, exert less. Take some time to read, go for a short walk or a bike ride. Today is not the day to push hard. I'm giving you permission to do less and find some joy in that. Sometimes resting is the most productive thing you can do. Or if you're feeling that way today, find a comfy spot for yourself, because I have Peter Kaminsky here on the program, a television producer and writer. Some great stories and conversation coming your way here. If you're new to the show, thanks for checking us out. This podcast is an exploration of health and what it means to you. Through the ideas and conversations you get only here on Highway to Health, I hope you might discover ways to enhance your day-to-day experience and define your wellness blueprint. If you're a regular listener, thanks for your continued support. I'd love to hear how you're implementing at least one thing that you've received here from any of the guests. Maybe a physical challenge you're working to overcome, maybe a mental health solution that you've been seeking and have found insight into. Maybe it's just a simple change of perspective that you've gotten from one of my guests or from me. Tell me about it. I'd love to hear about it. You can email me at jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. Also, if you've been enjoying the content and inspiration you've gotten here on Highway to Health, today is a great day for you to become a supporter, because we're deep into the building of our website and could really use some funding. Make a statement and let us know that you would like to hear more of these conversations and get more support and resource. It's very easy. Just go over to patreon.com/highwaytohealth. That's patreon.com/highwaytohealth. We've got different pledge levels so that anyone can afford, starting at just $1 a month. Also, you can learn more about the project in the 2-minute video that I do on the Patreon page. Also, don't forget, you can now listen to Highway to Health on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and Buzzsprout. And if you're going to be in the air or underground and want to listen to us there, just download the episode before you travel. I'm so excited to have to bring you today's conversation with Peter Kaminsky. For 20 years, he was co-producer of the Mark Twain Prize for Comedy, honoring the likes of Richard Pryor, Carol Burnett, Eddie Murphy, Bill Murray, Tina Fey, and a whole lot more. New Yorkers know him for his outdoor columns and the underground gourmet in the New York Times and New York Magazine. He's also published a number of books on food and fishing, which we discuss here in our conversation. Having studied anthropology in college, there seems to be a common thread running through all of his work that is a study of the human condition, our relationship with nature and communing with food and drink, and most importantly, finding the humor in it all. Please enjoy this conversation with me and Peter Kaminsky. I've read some of your fly fishing stuff, which I like a lot. I had my grandfather was a fisherman, not fly fisherman, but he fished for salmon in the UP and with big striped bass. Fishermen would go down to the Ozarks and, you know, fish mm-hmm. there with one of his nephews and stuff. So I learned fishing through him. So there's an aspect of, like, I see the thing that you kind of get into with fishing, which is like that so many people search for is being able to find that thing that really draws them in, you know, so the way you talk about it, the way time stops. And that's really kind of those, it's those moments that we're really searching for.
There are two things that I can do where I don't notice the passing of time, or maybe it passes on a different, you know, sidereal clock. But fishing and cooking. Huh. I can pretty much do that all day, and I'm not in a hurry. I'm not looking at my watch. So I'm very lucky that way.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned the UP. Years ago, I visited John Volker, whose pen name was Robert Traver.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned him in the book.
And he wrote Anatomy of a Murder.
That's right. He was a lawyer, right?
Oh, he was a lawyer, and then he was a small-town DA, and then he was a Michigan Supreme Court justice.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
In fact, in American legal jurisprudence, two of his rulings are still the highest ones. One was the skinny dipping case where he said public nudity is no offense to private decency. And no, private nudity is no offense to public decency.
That's right.
I take it both ways. And he also said in a divorce, if the woman makes more money, she can pay the alimony. Anyway, so I remember I visited him up in the UP. He had a cabin. Brook Trout, and I remember in writing about him and thinking about why he likes fly fishing, or how he likes fly fishing, how you describe it, or how I would. And I would say, I really can't tell you that. You give me anything else in the world that I like to a greater or lesser degree, yeah. I can tell you how it approximates fly fishing. That's my unit of measurement.
Yeah.
So
what? When did you start fly fishing?
I was working at National Lampoon in the 1970s, which was a very crazy, druggy place.
Totally.
And I took a vacation with my girlfriend in the Florida Keys, and it was cold. I remember it was 39 in Havana that week. And so there went the beach fantasy.
Yeah.
And I was just driving along. In Marathon, I think, in the Keys, and I saw, you know, snapper all day, $9, party boat. So I went. I mean, I had to do something.
Yeah.
And I caught a 35-pound grouper, which isn't the biggest grouper in the world, but it took the pool for the day. I think I went home with $52.
Was that the biggest fish you'd ever caught?
I think it was the only fish I'd ever caught at that point.
That's a good start.
But I really liked fishing. And for a year, maybe 2 years, I rented a garage with a cot in it up in near Woodstock, and I fished down at the Ashokan Reservoir with bait. Never really caught very much. Caught a lot of big sunnies,
yeah.
You know, and one smallmouth, as I recall. But I loved fishing. I mean, I would wake up early and go to the bait store and
yep.
And then I went to a place called Boca Pila in the Yucatan. No, I went to a place called Akumal in the Yucatan.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, even then, like almost 40 years ago, it was a little Club Medi for me.
Yeah.
So we took a drive down the coast and went past the pyramid in Tulum and made a right down this road. And it said Boca Pila fishing. Mouth of the kettle is Pila. So I went in. Had lunch with them just to see it, and they didn't charge me for lunch. I said, come on back if you want to fish. So I did. And that was with a spinning rod. I caught bonefish and permit. But I saw these guys fly fishing, and I thought it was really cool.
Huh.
And I came back to New York,
What do they fly fish for down there?
Bonefish, permit, and tarpon, baby tarpon.
Okay.
And I came back to New York, and there was a woman, Marcia Norman, not the playwright, Marcia Norman, who was working for Michael Gross, a design studio. He'd been the art director of National Lampoon.
Okay.
And we were having drinks, and she was talking about fly fishing. And her husband, Jeff Norman, an ex-Green Beret, wonderful writer, is with Esquire and Playboy. He loved to fly fish. I said, we're going away for the weekend. So come on up to the Beaver Kill, and we'll show you something.
Yeah.
And I went there, and I remember we were standing on this bridge over the Willowemoc Creek, a famous sacred water of American fly fishing. And it was lousy weather. No one was catching anything. I saw this guy just like shoot these lasers out, you know, the beautiful straight casts to that place in an old bridge abutment where there's always a fish, but yeah. No one ever catches it. Yeah. And he caught it. And so I remember he came up and he was walking to his car across the bridge, and I had a flask and I offered him some bourbon. And it turned out he was quite a well-known fishing author named Doug Swisher. And he was giving a 3-day clinic. So I went to fly casting school. It's invaluable. And that's what I did. And when I got fired from Lampoon, which is something that happens to everybody.
How long were you there?
4 years. So I needed to make a living. So the bar was really low for outdoor writers. So I started writing about fishing and Field and Stream, Outdoor Life. The Times came along, and I've, you know, written for them for 30 years, just about. And that's me and fishing.
What writing had you done before writing about fishing?
The Lampoon.
The Lampoon, okay.
I was kind of a B-flat comedy writer.
Yeah.
I mean, I could do it okay enough. I wasn't a genius.
And I did a little digging, and I've known you for quite a while, but I had no idea that your dad was a comedy writer as well.
Yes, he wrote for Jackie Gleason.
That's amazing. So how did that relationship start? How did they get to know each other to write to that level?
My dad and Jackie Gleason?
Yeah. Because you grew up in New York, right?
In New Jersey.
In New Jersey, okay.
Well, perhaps the most successful comedy writer in America in the 50s and into the 60s was a guy named Marvin Marks. He was a bloody genius. And he invented the Honeymooners. Him and a guy named Walter Stone wrote all 39 of them. And he wrote for Sid Caesar. I remember when I was a young boy, conversation being that he was making $8,000 a week in the late 50s. But the guy lived in a garden apartment in East Orange, New Jersey, and drove a Morris Minor. He was so afraid, of dying poor that he didn't spend a dime. And, of course, he dropped dead like of an embolism or an aneurysm when he was 42.
Of course.
But Marvin was writing for Jackie Gleason, okay. And my dad and he were friends. My dad had a kiddie show on NBC called Pip the Piper. And he was an entertainer, performer, and he went to work for Jackie Gleason.
At that point, did he just switch over into writing, or did he stay as an entertainer?
No, he switched over into writing. That was only a couple of years, and then he came back and got into advertising again as a writer in New York.
Yeah. And you, was that part of what gave you the bug, seeing that?
I never thought of it that way. Perhaps it did, but not consciously.
Yeah.
I just didn't want a job,
And comedy we had it on television at that point, but it wasn't the same kind of thing that we think of comedy today either. Lampoon at that point was like,
no, you could say anything, write anything.
No one had ever even tried anything like that before.
Not in America.
Yeah. Was there something in Europe or something?
Well, there were, was it Black Dwarf? I mean, there were some, some really strong stuff coming out of England and out of France as well. Other places I may not be aware of, but, they were pretty fearless.
Yeah. So one thing I was wondering about just reading through that, I forget the name of the book, but it's kind of your lessons about, lessons on life from...
Fly Fisherman's Guide to the Meaning of Life.
Meaning of Life. And there was a piece in there where clearly you were a baseball fan, and you know, you sort of talked about your moment, you know, going into Yankee Stadium, and then later in the book you were talking about like the 90 feet of line. Is there a correlation? Is that what the amount of line is for fly fishers, or does that change?
Well, the classic line, I mean, everything's gotten more specialized and expertized, you know, in our era, but the classic fly fishing line is 90 feet long.
Which is roughly the distance to home plate from pitching mound, isn't it? Is
that 60 feet.
Oh, it's 60 feet. For some reason,
you'll be in America a while to get it.
I tried playing baseball for
90
a
feet
bit,
between bases.
90 feet between bases. Maybe that's what it is. But I thought that was an interesting correlation between the two.
No, the thing I was writing about there was, I called it the Yankee Stadium view, was how when I was, I guess the first game I ever went to, you know, you go, you're in the Bronx and you go, you know, in the bowels of this stadium, and it's kind of loud and dreary and dark. And then you walk down this entryway, and boom, it's this like green world.
Coming from, and you were saying like, your view of baseball until that point had been black and white television.
That's right.
So this must have just been like an explosion, probably in the same way that...
And I can't for the life of me remember how I related that to fishing, but I did in that book.
I know, and I thought it was about this distance.
No, it was
like,
about...
I liked that idea of like you kind of like pitching the line almost in the same way that the pitcher pitched.
It was just about seeing something up close, real, and panoramic. Yeah. For the first time.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful image. I mean, I know that feeling of, I've done a lot of like shore fishing. I mean, I've never done fly fishing, but there's certainly those moments where you're just trying to find an inn, a good place where you can kind of stand out there on the shore, and you know, you kind of find your way through, and then you get this panoramic view. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things I always loved about fishing, was you could kind of find different ways of doing it. You know, sometimes I'd just throw a line over the edge of a boat that I'd rowed out somewhere, and you know, that you just get this feel. You know, it's kind of funny because it's, I think about it with my work sometimes. You know, I do this kind of gentle osteopathic work, and it feels similar to the way that I would have just a line without any sort of, you know, bobber or without a cast, where you just hang it kind of trying to feel the mm-hmm, bottom mm-hmm. a little bit and then feel for mm-hmm, the hits. Mm-hmm. And I got very good at fishing that way without, you know, too much technical training. You just kind of get that feel for what that is. And it's the same thing for setting the hook too. I think you just have to be able to like feel that, you know.
Different for every kind of fish, every species.
True.
You know, setting a hook on a trout will pull the hook out of the mouth of a striped bass or a tarpon. You know, the same set. It's
too much pressure.
Well, with a trout, typically you raise the rod and it comes taut and it drives the hook home. If you do that with a striper or a tarpon or many fish, you're going to pull, it's just going to pull it right out of the mouth. Mm. You have to point it at the fish, and with your left hand, it's called a strip set, pull hard, and that drives the hook in.
Huh.
So, you know, some fish you need to feel tap, 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 and then you'll feel a little bit more resistance, and that's when you really haul back on it.
Yeah.
You know, and some fish you just feel a little tap and go, do it right now.
Yeah. So how long ago did you write that book? Has it been 10 years or more than that?
Guide to the Meaning of Life?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's been a while. It's funny. It was put out by Rodale Press.
Yeah.
Then they sold it. I forget to who. Another thing. So they reissued it, and they put like a new cover on it. Not much of a cover, I must say. But it says, but you know, 5 years to Meaning of Life. By winner of the U.S. PGA Masters Tournament, Peter Kaminsky, because they had a fly fisher, they had a golfer's guide to the meaning of life, and I guess like it was Gary Player or something, and no one bothered to change the line on the cover.
So do you having done that work is of writing that book, are there things that you're clearly still fishing, do you go back and think about some of those?
Oh, sure, all the time.
Yeah.
That was a really good book to do. It was a good book to do.
Yeah.
It's a short book.
Yeah.
And I just had to get it done. And it wasn't like researching a lot or I needed to do a lot. It was, you know, write about what you've done in notes. It was like a letter.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think I wrote it in 3 weeks.
Oh, wow. I really liked that. I thought the writing was really, like, you kind of got into some things. And then you would look at the way someone fished and talk about why you can't say that that's the wrong way to do something or that, you know, and you're just using fishing as an example, but the metaphors were so strong for like so many different ways of talking. You could be talking about religion, you could be talking about lifestyle, you could be talking about all these different things. And it was like so clear the way that you kind of wrote
it in that piece. It's very individual in that it's always how you connect.
Yeah.
You know, whatever your path is to do that thing, whether it's fishing or praying or cooking or fucking or whatever.
Right.
You know, how you do it and what leaves you connected to it and it opens it up for you. It's not the same for everybody.
Yeah.
In fact, it's usually not the same for any two people.
Yeah. And I think there are some general rules, just as there are probably in religion, that they kind of run the gamut across, like, you know, in the way that you shouldn't get too greedy about certain kinds of things. But, you know, to say for one person to do catch and release and for one person to say, I'm taking 10 fish today, you know, that's within reason, you know, and also it's your choice to choose to catch and release.
Well, yeah, let me say that. In fact, I just wrote about this somewhat last week in the Times about a recent trip to Argentina. The thing about, listen, everything gets eaten. Everything gets eaten, whether you eat it or something else eats it after it dies or what, everything gets eaten. That's just the way the world is. So, you know, there are two aspects to catch and release, you know, for me. One is a lot of the fish that I like to catch are top predators.
Yeah.
There are far fewer trout in a stream than there are minnows. Mm. There are far fewer lions, not a fish, than there are impala or gazelles.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to degrade the population of a predator.
Right.
So if you value the fishery, by and large, catch and release is a good practice. Now, on the other hand, you know, if someone wants to catch something and eat it, it's fine, but, you know,
yeah.
I'm not standing in judgment of that at all. I do think, however, that people who just catch and indiscriminately kill everything, it's, you know, not particularly moral, not particularly practical, not particularly admirable.
Yeah, I mean, especially practical. I mean, from a conservationist standpoint, I mean, that's the basis.
Exactly. So, but it's interesting. I didn't get any letters about this. So this last piece I wrote about was this. I guess there's a couple of ways you can go as you, I don't want to say mature, but just grow older as a fisherman.
Yeah.
You know, one is you go, oh, I just love the pleasure of it and the beauty and being outside and, you know, what I catch doesn't matter that much.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those people. So, in fact, the older I've gotten, the more I want to catch really big fish.
I can understand that, though.
And in the south of Argentina, the trout get enormous. I mean, the winds, you can, no exaggeration, be fishing in 60-mile-an-hour winds with a fly rod, and it's cold, and that's what it takes, and you'll catch some big fish. So there was this lake I'd been to. They call it Jurassic Lake. And I'd been there some years ago. I really liked it. It's a very barren, steppe-like environment. It's Patagonia, but it's not the beautiful Montana-like mountains.
Yeah.
And this mesa just drops off, boom, 200 feet, basalt cliffs, and then it's Caribbean blue water. And the lake is full of freshwater shrimp, scud. It's got one stream that fish can spawn in, and it's got rainbows. So it's a little stream. They don't have a lot of population competition in the lake because their spawning capacity of the stream is limited. and they have all the food in the world. And it's cold water, so they get big and they get strong. So I'd been there, and, you know, and all I'd caught the first time was a bunch of only 8-pound fish on the flies. You know, fish of a lifetime anywhere else, but people caught some biggies. So I went back this year and caught some big fish, including a 20-pound, 8-ounce rainbow. And so I wrote it up for the Times, and they, and I mean, the end of the story is that I caught this beautiful, beautiful fish, and me and the guide who was with me, we tried for a half hour to revive the thing. But every time we let her go, you know, go on her side and see her, it just wouldn't revive. You know, we were forcing water through the gills by moving her back and forth. So took her back to the lodge and ate her. It was great. So my editor asked me, why don't you start with trying to release the fish and then come back to it at the end of the story? So I said, okay. And so I got down to that part towards the end, and I said, speaking to most fishermen I know who are fly fishermen, don't go nuts about catch and release here. I said that released fish don't always survive. Mm-hmm. If you're going to eat it, it ain't the worst thing in the world.
Right.
You know, don't judge another by your own standards. And if I may, I remember on one of my first trips to Argentina, a very famous stream is called the Chimiwin, and both the world record rainbow and, world record brown trout on a dry fly and a wet fly had come out of that river. So it's like this caldera, and it's broken on one side, and the river flows out of that. So I was there. It was really cold weather, and it was raining. And this guy, Bob White from Minneapolis, great artist and fishing guide, he hooked this gorgeous fish on a dry fly, on a caddisfly. And fishing down the stream from us was a fellow named Charles Radziwill. He was an older guy, one of the prince from Lithuania, one of the famous gang of, you know, the pioneers of Argentine fly fishing. So he saw this happening, and he came up, and as Bob's pulling the, landing the fish, Charlie reaches in and grabs it by the gills and picks it up, and it spouts blood all over the place. And so that was that. That was, a dead trout. But I just recalled the moral high ground of all the people I was with, like, really saying what a barbarian he was and how terrible this is. Confusing catch and release as a conservation principle as opposed to catch and release as, you know, a moral principle. And, you know, I remember saying to them right there, look, this guy was a Polish prince. They used to line up 600 peasants at a time and cut their heads off. This was like nice behavior on his part. Yeah. So, anyway.
And for him, it's sport and just food, probably.
Well, catch and release is an American thing, you know, in Europe. They, you know, shoot everything in the sky and, you know, catch and kill every fish they can, pretty much. So that's all, you know, that's changing a little bit, but that's, it was an American conservation ethic because we have free access public lands. Mm. My T-shirt, keep public lands in public hands. And that's, it was really a wonderful thing. I fear, you know, with everything else in our country going to the 0.001%.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how long all that's going to last, but it is that tradition of, you know, public lands and free access to fishing and hunting that sort of engendered catch and release and conservation measures.
Was that not the case in Europe?
No. Still isn't.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
Oh, you got to pay.
I had no idea.
You got to pay.
And you know, I also think just given the state of global wellness at this point that conservation is going to have to be something that's taught a little bit more if we're going to actually do things the right way. I mean, and there are some places in the world, obviously, where it's not an issue, but, you know, certainly
not many. And listen, let's be frank about it. You can be as conservation minded as you want, but if we don't do something to control, you know, the carbonization of the atmosphere,
right.
It's all going to boil away.
are there any places in the world that are like your favorite places to go still?
They all are, you know? I mean, we're talking in Brooklyn right now.
Yeah.
And there's extraordinary fishing and fly fishing. End of this block in the harbor there, I've caught many striped bass, bluefish, false albacore. It's spectacular, you know. In the spring and the fall, it's great.
Oh, but by the way, what's the difference between the dry fly and wet fly for anyone who's listening, doesn't have any idea about this?
Well, if you ever looked at a trout stream, you'll see these flies floating on the surface, insects.
Yeah.
They weren't born on the surface. They were born underneath.
Ah.
And then they split their shells open like a cocoon with a butterfly.
Yeah.
And they rise to the surface, and they grow wings. They dry the wings off. They fly up in the air, stay there for a day, fly over the stream, screw for the first time, have a heart attack, and die.
This is the same day?
Or the next day. This is a very good life cycle. I mean, it's a better ending.
You're right.
A happy ending.
Yeah.
So a dry fly imitates those recently hatched flies who are at that point where they're just floating on the surface of the stream.
What kind of flies? What are they called?
Mayflies, caddisflies, stoneflies, sedge flies. The mayfly is the prince of them.
Okay.
And a wet fly is that same animal in its, you know, pre-hatch form, its larval or nymphal form. They crawl around, they live, you know, under the rocks. And
yeah. Do you have a preference as far as what you like to fish with?
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing like a brown trout on a dry fly. It requires quite a delicate presentation. When you see a fish and it doesn't know you're there, and you put that thing out and it floats down in front of it and it takes it, you really feel moral.
Yeah. And is it the same kind of thing as like the difference between hunters who like to bow hunt or you know, use a rifle in terms of hunting? Is it that kind of challenge? Or is it...
I'm not sure that's what it is. It's just, it's a very, what's so satisfying is that it's visual.
Mm.
From the time you see the fish till it takes or it doesn't, you're seeing the whole thing. Where like you were talking about, you know, bouncing bait or lure off the bottom.
Yeah.
You hope something, your excitement only starts when you feel it.
Right.
You know, not when you don't see it.
You don't see it. I mean, I've done some bass fishing before too, and that's a little more of the visual game because you're usually sort of
You know, plugs on top when a bass explodes on that.
Yeah,
wakes you up
for a long time. So how did the food writing stuff? How was that born?
Well, I've always cooked my whole life. I'm a short order cook, you know, burger flipper. Always cooked at home. I like cooking, and in my New York Times stories, every one of them, I believe, you know, it's like 150 of them, it's the outdoors column, 900 words, it's a specific form. I'd always have something to eat, whether it was just a Clark bar or a brownie or a roast pork sandwich or whatever it was, be some food, because food pulls you into a story like your own name does on the page. You just go to it, because we want to eat, you know. And so one year in the mid-90s, I did a series called A Season on the Harbor in the New York Times. And every month I'd fish a different place in New York City waters. And that was a way for me to write not only about the fishing, but about the city and characters and history and the environment and stuff. It was a wonderful experience. So the last one of the year was December. And my college roommate, Vinny Farrell, we would always have Christmas lunch. And Vinny, you know, a guy from a real blue-collar background in, you know, Westchester County, became a very, very successful financial guy and big giver to charity. He was a great guy. He died a few years ago. But anyway, we'd have Christmas lunch. And so I'd been out with my daughter, Lucy, who was whatever at the time, 8 or 9 or 10, and we were fishing on a party boat, you know, a group boat out of Sheepshead Bay at the end of Brooklyn, where most of the guys on the boat didn't fish. They just played nickel a point pinochle down below. We're fishing for blackfish, a local fish also known as a tautog. And there was this guy next to us named Eddie Doles. And he kept pulling in the fish, and he showed us how to do it. Eddie had been like the walrus keeper at the Coney Islands Aquarium, a really interesting fellow. Wow. Anyway, so Lucy and I caught a bunch of fish. So Vinny wanted to go have Christmas lunch. So Michael LaMonaco was the chef at the 21 Club. And I knew him through fishing. I wasn't a food writer at the time. I'd given him some advice about gear to get for his son.
Okay.
So I called Mike up and I said, I got a dozen blackfish or maybe six blackfish and a dozen fillets. If I bring them by, I want to have lunch. So you cook us some, you can sell the rest and we'll do this thing. So I went there and I remember I was in 21 Club, which was quite a grand place. And I'm standing on line with my little igloo cooler. And right behind me is Ethel Kennedy and Frank Gifford. So Frank says, who I didn't know, did you bring your lunch? I said, matter of fact, I did. Yeah. And so we talked. Turns out he was a striper fisherman. He had a place in Connecticut. So I wrote about that. And then we sat down, we had dinner, and we watched Michael cook. And I remember we had scallops with white truffles. My God, were they great. And the fish he did with a crispy skin. I forget what else he did to us. It was just a spectacular meal. Good wine. And so I wrote it up in the Times. And they probably gave me 3/4 of a page. It was very unusual.
Yeah.
And it was a picture of Eddie, on the boat, this like Brooklyn guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And Michael in the kitchen, like, flipping pans, your classic chef thing. And I got more mail from that one story, maybe, except for 9/11, where I got a lot of response, but that one story, then everything else combined in my writing life. So I said, food. So I started to write about food. And do you know Kurt Anderson on NPR, CBS 360?
Yeah, yeah.
So Kurt was the editor of Spy Magazine at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I had, I was, we were friends and we were trying to sell a TV show. We did sell a few TV shows from Spy. And it was like being with the Lampoon all over again, just such smart young people there. But anyway, Kurt had left there and he became editor of New York Magazine for a while. And there was a place called Union Square Cafe, Danny Meyer, very successful modern restaurateur.
Yeah.
And he was opening Gramercy Tavern. And my office was above Union Square. And I said, Danny, can I write about this, for the New Yorker? I got an assignment from the New Yorker. And so I wrote The Making of a Restaurant. And Tina Brown was the editor of New Yorker at the time, and she didn't like the story. She used to kill a lot of stories. I was devastated.
What does she not like about it,
It just doesn't sing, is what she said.
Okay.
And maybe it didn't. I don't know. But at any rate, I called up Kurt, and I said, Kurt, remember you said you'd kill for this story? And he said, yeah. I said, you don't have to. So Tina paid me very well, and then Kurt bought the piece. It was like 8,000 words, and it was on the cover of the magazine. It was just, there never had been such a, I won't say wonderful, but such a, extensive piece on how a restaurant happens.
Yeah.
And so I was a food writer.
Huh.
And I started writing The Underground Gourmet for New York Magazine on a monthly basis, which was sort of like a lot of ethnic food. An entry-level kind of, fine dining, but...
But it seems to suit your taste, too. Exploring things that way, the way you have, even with, looking for places to fish or the cultures that you kind of get to be part of in doing those kinds of things. You're like, I feel like that seems to be a theme in all the things that you're doing.
Yeah, I like this. Well, when I first came to New York in the early 70s, I was a cabbie.
Oh, yeah. I think I knew that.
I was a hippie cabbie.
Yeah.
And I just got practiced the art of drive-by dining, you know? I could just have a feeling when I looked at a place, how the staff seemed to be, you know, were they zipping around the room?
Yeah.
Were the diners talking to each other? Or just like, you know, a couple of waiters looking at their watches and...
It tells you a lot about a place, I think, that the sort of energy of the vibe of a place, like what the food's going to be like.
Well, it does and it doesn't. I've always said that if you take a place with great food and kind of not a great front of the house experience, you know, the dining room,
yeah,
or if you take a place with okay food and just great front of the house, I'll go back to that second place.
Yeah.
You just, you know, because eating is not just, you know, squat and gobble, you know?
Yeah.
You're there, it's social, it's a feeling, you're talking to somebody or you're reading something, I don't know, but, you know, it's just not like, here, take it or leave it, buddy.
Right. There is something about, I don't know, one of the best dining experiences I ever had had to do with a locale. It was in Positano in Italy.
Oh, sure.
So you're on the Amalfi Coast. It's beautiful. There's the... Have you been before?
No.
I've been
to Italy, but not to the Amalfi Coast.
Positano just has like, you know, I think a lot of these Amalfi Coast towns have a little road that has to kind of wind down and get down there. And they also have like little steps winding, you know, in different ways.
Sure.
Trying to get down towards the beach where everyone wants to go eventually. But there was this one with this amazing lookout. It was set up almost kind of like outdoor cafeteria style. It was dead. Nobody was there. It was lunchtime. Maybe not Italian lunchtime, but it was lunchtime for me.
Gringo lunchtime.
That's right. And so I was with somebody, and we walked in, and there was a guy in the kitchen leaning leaning back on a chair, sleeping. older guy. So I stood there for a minute and thought, nah, I don't want to bug this guy. And all of a sudden, he kind of looked over at us, and he's like, said something in Italian. And I said, "Due." And he got up. He just pointed us to a table. He handed us a menu with two items on it, and a red or white wine. And so, you know, we just pointed to the things that we wanted. One of the best meals I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just went back to sleep.
You can't separate the experience from the place and the people.
Yes.
You know, they say the activity of, I studied anthropology in college. The activity is called commensalism, people dining together. It's one of the distinctive features of human beings, yeah, sharing a meal.
Yeah. And I think... Again, there's a theme in the way that I think there's a commencing with the work that you've, you know, done with, I think, both the your fishing, but also the other big thing that you've done in your life with your brother is your partner, right? For the Mark Twain
prize,
yeah, which is right, this kind of like, you know, bringing of people together in this celebratory thing for, you know, clearly humor is like a big deal for you, and to be able to do something like that.
Well, the Twain Prize, which we're out of now, we sold our interest to the Kennedy Center.
Okay,
but we did it for 20 years.
That's a long time,
you know, and made it up. But the way we did that show was, first thing was, you know, if you're not familiar with it, your listeners, it's every year we would honor an American humorist.
Yeah.
And we would bring other people and we'd show clips of their work. And the other people were told they couldn't just do I Love You, Man. They had to be funny.
Yeah.
And we had just great people. And when you're honoring someone who other people like or who gives them work,
yeah,
people show up. But we never had a host on that show. I always thought that was the most artificial thing in the world, just to have somebody give like a keynote, yeah, like a 5-6 minute funny, and then the show. Because I think the host thing is so artificial. It just, and I was happy to see the Oscars did that this year,
yeah,
and I thought it was a better show for it. And the other thing that we did was, you know, we'd have this big green room, you know, like bullpen backstage, where people the cast would all hang out, and we'd have the show as it progressed on the screen in there. And we had a nice dinner the night before. So it wasn't, people got to hang out. It wasn't a lot of pressure.
And in a way that they often don't in these in these kind of awards situations.
Yeah. And I never, maybe twice, or maybe once, had two people come out at the same time. Because that's always the most, artificial thing, Bet, gosh, could you spend more on your hairdo tonight? You should talk, Mr. Bold Ben Kingsley. It's just like so forced.
It's so true. That's great.
So I had a lot of great times. A lot of great times on that show.
It's funny that you got like that. Seems like the right way to celebrate, though, to have a dinner before the award ceremony to like. You're sort of bringing everybody together. It's like this honor that, everybody's who's getting invited to this.
And they'd also get rid of their nerves about being in Washington and could try it. A very funny one was we had a dinner. Bob Newhart was the honoree. I've worked with Bob a lot over the years. A very decent guy. And who was there? Was Carl Reiner there? Tom Poston, Jane Curtin, Tommy Smothers. So it was a smaller dinner than these affairs metastasized into, as things do in Washington. But I remember people got up and, gave a little toast. And then Tim Conway. Remember Tim Conway?
Oh, I love Tim Conway.
There's never been a funnier man on earth. So he stands up from the table. A very serious look on his face, and he looks around and pauses a minute to capture the attention of everybody, and he said, like almost as if he was about to weep, he said, "I can truthfully say that I have never had a piece of salmon go through me so quickly." And then he sat down.
Man. Very him.
Yeah.
But to be able to like have, I mean, this is funny. It's funny to think about, but the thing about having a big meal like that and hang out with everybody is that everybody starts to let down their guard. And then to have the show after that, it's gotta be so much lighter than, the way the Academy Awards happens or something where you wouldn't eat the day before cause you got to fit into your clothes.
Safe way.
But it feels so uptight. Like I can't stand, one of those things that I've never been able to do is watch the sort of red carpet stuff. It makes me so uncomfortable for these people. Mm-hmm. And they do it well most of the time, but it feels so forced. And this is, but this is the way that we think of real life.
It's become ritualized.
Yeah. It's become ritualized. Yeah.
So it was great. And, but I'll tell you, not dealing with, publicists and managers and, stars who were hard to get a hold of or ones who are don't tell me what to do and have an attitude and won't take any help. I mean, we always had really good writers if they needed them. It's a big anxiety load off my shoulders. Yeah. I just like writing.
Yeah. What gave you guys the idea to do this thing in the first place?
So my brother and I, they'd like killed off a bunch of producers. It was the 20th anniversary of People Magazine. So that would have been 93. And so we had done Spy Magazine on TV. We did it with Jerry Seinfeld, did another one with Kevin Nealon. So we knew something about taking the idea of a magazine and putting it on TV. So they called us. They'd been through a bunch of executive producers. We're still getting paid.
Yeah.
And so it was a 2-hour show. It was a monster. And it was so hard to book people.
Yeah.
No star wanted to deal with People Magazine. Only do it if you're in rehab or if your kid died,
Yeah.
Otherwise, they don't need it.
Yeah.
And I remember trying to get to Oprah. It's some, hairdresser who knew a dog walker, who knew the postman, you know, who would deliver a letter. It was impossible. All right. So I got a call from a thing called the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens, and they would do a yearly fundraiser at the Waldorf Astoria, and they were honoring Steven Spielberg. And would I write it? And I said, sure. And so at the same time, like, I couldn't get to Oprah or this one or that one. I go down the list of people who worked for Spielberg, and I'd like be sitting in my office, you know, we were with Time Life then, because that's where People is. I remember sitting there one night, and it's, hello, Peter? Yeah, Ope. So I said, well, did you know, there's this thing, Steven Spielberg. She said, sure. She said, can you say anything about it? I said, oh, yeah, I did already. She said, well, no one ever showed it to me.
Yeah.
She said, just fax it over. I'll just run down the hall to the fax machine and get it. I said, this is easy. And so, and then, I forget who else jumped in there. Maybe Ben Kingsley and Liam Neeson. I mean, Goldie Hawn. I mean, these unapproachable, you know, big stars.
Yeah.
And a little light bulb went off, and I said, well, if you honor one person, people have a reason. It's just not like, you know, a bunch of tuxedos. And so in 95, someone had tried it, and they called us in to rescue it. There were Colin Powell put together this big event with all the living presidents or spouses, in case of Reagan, for volunteerism, you know, help at risk youth. It was like 3 weeks out, and we just, it wasn't going to happen. And we just made it happen. We just threw people and ideas and everything at it, and it got done. So we had a friend in the Clinton White House at that point. Ann Stock was the social secretary. Mm. And so just one day I was saying, you know, I forget what I was doing. I was just sitting there. I said, well, at the Museum of the Moving Image, which I'd done another one for Robin Williams the next year, you know, you do this thing with one person and people come. Mm-hmm. And there really is no national award for comedy.
Hmm.
So we had worked with, produced the Montreal Comedy Festival for a number of years for TV. And we had honored George Burns 1 year. That was before he died.
Yeah.
Clearly. And so I went to see Ann, first time ever at the White House. And I said, well, here's what we'd like to do. And, you know, we'd like to call it the Mark Twain Prize and honor George Burns. And she said, well, I think that's a great idea. And then Whitewater and, you know, General Flowers and everything exploded.
Yeah.
And Monica, a woman who I admire, I got to tell you. Mm. I mean, I follow her on Twitter. She's really smart and got great spirit. So Anne left the White House. And she was at the Kennedy Center. George had died, George Burns. And then one of our partners, Mark Krantz, called and said, you know, people, I think it was at Motown, I called him and said, you know, Richard Pryor is, you know, not doing well. It would be great if you could honor him.
Hmm.
So we went to the Kennedy Center and pitched the show. You know, Ann was there. The head was Larry Wilker. It took us 20 seconds to sell it.
Wow.
I mean, done. So that's how it started.
It was funny. I was looking back through that, and I was looking at the timelines, and I was like, was Richard, when you guys started that, was, because I knew that was the first one, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I didn't know if he was still alive at that point.
Oh, he was. He was wheelchair bound.
Okay.
He could communicate to the extent that he could smile and gesture, and he really enjoyed it. We almost didn't get involved with a 7 year. There were so many F-bombs flung on the stage of the Kennedy Center, which had never happened. But we survived.
Why did you call it Mark Twain?
Just because it sounded like something that had been around for 100 years. It sounded like
true.
Washington had one.
And he was a great humorist.
Oh, yeah. Oh, extremely which I don't funny
think,
man.
I don't think people think about him that way, but...
Oh, they do.
Yeah.
They do, yeah.
I remember reading when iPads first came on the market, or maybe shortly after, finally, and maybe it took me a couple of years to finally get one, and one of the free books they had on there was I think it was Huck Finn. And
amazing book.
And my son was like 7 at the time, and I was like, is it too much to read this to a 7-year-old? And I just started kind of like, you know, telling him about the story a little bit, and he's like, well, you can read it to me. You know, I was like, so I started reading it. You know, there's some tricky points in there because they use the N-word and...
252 times.
252 times.
I think. That's yeah. what I remember.
And so, I mean, but it was interesting because it was definitely something I had to talk to him about, like, in that moment. I mean, we're in Brooklyn, too, you know, so... But there were some scenes in there that I don't think I picked up on the funniness of when I had to read them for high school or whatever it was. There was the one in particular where, you know, after he's found the loot and, mm-hmm. you know, he's his, you know, bum of a father, alcoholic, has taken him, stolen him, brought him up river somewhere into some cabin. His father beats him, you know, daily, pretty often, but
for exercise.
But at least he doesn't have to take baths and go to school,
right?
Right. And I remember laughing out loud and realizing my son probably doesn't realize
he's an extremely funny man. A few years ago, there's every 4 years there's a gathering of Mark Twain scholars in Elmira, New York, which is where his summer house was. It's actually his wife's family, but that's where they went every summer. And so they invited me to give a keynote speech. They wanted me to talk about, I had edited a book of Twain's travel writings. Mm. So that sort of like legitimized me, but they wanted me to tell, you know, showbiz stories about the Mark Twain Prize. And we did. But the really cool thing was, they gave my wife Melinda and I Twain's house for 4 days.
Wow.
Which, you know, it was on the bunch of rolling hills that go down to the Susquehanna River. It's just so green, you know, you could cry. And it was this cool house.
Did you fish?
No. I did go and visit a farmer who raised and still raises really great grass-fed beef.
Mm. Your other passion has writing seems to recently, and speaking of beef, has been pigs.
Yeah.
Specifically the how do you pronounce it? Iberico?
Iberico.
Iberico.
That's the Spanish, the hog
the
that you find
that
in Spain.
From? Yeah.
And Siberian. But really, it was the only pig that was in Europe before the 18th century.
Hmm.
All the other breeds came in trade with the Far East. They were sort of these pigs had been bred, you know, through the millennia for, to, you know, not be aggressive, to live near your farm, put on fat quick. But Iberico hog's the original hog in the world. And the way that happened was I'd written a book called The Moon Pulled Up an Acre of Bass, which was about, well, every day for a month in October, I fished for striped bass during the migration at Montauk Point.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
And I'd also to write about the migration of ducks and geese and whales and monarch butterflies and a lot of the crazy bootlegger history and American history.
Yeah,
it was,
yeah.
You know, immersion in a place. And so my editor said, you know, afterwards, said, well, now we'd like you to do a, quotes, writing book. About food. And I didn't have an idea. And one day I'm in a shower, which is where Virginia Woolf said you get your ideas. So I guess I don't shower enough. We don't have that many. But I'm saying, you know, every time I've been on the road, like for, you know, the outdoor magazines in the South, I'd always see if someone made a good country ham. Because traditionally they do down there. You buy them at a gas station, wherever it is. Mm. And I love it. I love the stuff. So I said, why don't I try to find the greatest country ham in the world, or the greatest ham in the world. And I wrote a letter saying, like, here are some of my experiences that I've had when I, you know, writing outdoor stories of being in the South. And so I said, I want to just go find the greatest one, and I'll call the book Pig Perfect, which is a pretty good name. It kind of, sold itself.
Yeah.
And but once you, as I learned, once you start looking for the perfect ham, you got to find the perfect pig that's raised right, that's fed the right stuff, that's free range enough, that's gets old enough so it develops some fat in the, you mm-hmm. know, in the muscles. And that led me to Spain, where they just, they have like the run of like 300 miles, and they eat acorns, which are really high in so-called healthy fats, monounsaturated fat.
Yeah.
They call them, and that's why they call the pig over there the four-footed olive tree.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it really, and they were eating acorns in that part of the world before wheat. So they've been breeding them a lot. And I've eaten Spanish acorns. They're sweet. It's not like, biting one into one here.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful fat. It's a sweet meat. And so that's how I wrote that book.
Oh, that's and the stuff that I've read that you've kind of gotten into with the discussion of pigs also, again, it's sort of similar to the things that you like to dig into, which is like looking at the culture and the history and the religion aspects around the, even with pigs.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, stuff that I had no idea about.
Well, good. I'm glad it served a purpose.
Well, I mean, I think it's one of those things that for most people, I think, especially with food, and that's what I think you've done so well is that, and with a lot of the writing, even when it just about whatever your joy and your passion for fly fishing is that the real sort of joie de vivre is the details is really getting into like. The layers upon layers of things. And once you get into it, and I think we should know more about our food. And I think part of the reason that we sort of suffer some of the health issues that we have is because we're not paying enough attention to some of these things.
That's true.
I feel like you kind of, 10 years ago or something that you had some health stuff going on and you
had cancer.
And you made some huge like wholesale.
Oh, well that came after.
Right.
I went for life insurance and I weighed like 40 pounds more than I do now.
Yeah. Was that part of the byproduct of your work?
Yeah, absolutely. An occupational hazard. And I was rejected for life insurance.
Is that right?
Because I was pre-diabetic. So I had to lose weight.
Yeah.
And I changed the way I ate and wrote a book about that, Culinary Intelligence.
Yeah.
When I look at it now, nutritional advice, changes from week to week.
Right,
the great nutrition writer Marion Nestle said, for every PhD, there's an equal but opposite PhD. But it by and large, I think it holds up.
Yeah.
What I learned about nutrition and weight. Then some years later, when I had cancer, I was fit. Well, listen, you're not going to, run your way out of cancer. I mean, you get it or you don't, and it's the luck of the draw. But then if you have a kind that you have a chance of beating you can withstand treatment and you're in good, strong shape, you get through it.
Yeah.
So I think it had something to do with that.
What do you feel like you learned nutrition-wise or what's stuck from that understanding that you got?
Well, I mean, a few things. You buy vitamin-enriched, milk. It's hard to find it that doesn't have vitamin enrichment in it or bread. Or you take vitamin pills. One thing I've learned is you can't separate nutrients out from the food that they're a part of. And that your body, for example, fruit juice is probably no more healthy for you than Coca-Cola.
Right.
Or maybe marginally so. But what really the real problem with fruit juice is it's sugar.
It's fructose.
When you eat fruit that hasn't been juiced, you're eating all that cellulose and stuff. So your body...
Bioflavonoids and all these pieces.
But also just the absorption of sugar is not... It's not like mainlining it.
Right. There's a barrier. Fiber creates this barrier, so you're kind of getting it in bits and spurts.
Likewise, you know, whole grains are converted to sugar much less rapidly than refined...
Processed.
...stuff. Processed stuff. So... Eating whole ingredients is important.
It's very similar to what changed for me. I mean, my shift kind of came out of having a period of chronic back pain, which, you know, I kind of went after what I always feel like are the sort of main elements of just, you know, having some balance in life, which are sleep, eating better. These things I kind of go back to every time I feel like if I get a couple of colds in a row, I start looking at my, you know, just sort of the basics, and then exercising, like, and not in the extreme version, but what you're talking about is exactly what I, you know, I mean, I studied some nutrition for a while too. I considered doing that as a job and realized I probably needed a PhD in psych if I was going to help people with their eating habits. But you know, it is so much more simple. It's just a matter of organizing.
Well, like the main, like, little mantra that I took from it all was what I call flavor per calorie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that.
If you can up the amount of flavor, you know, sensual satisfaction you get from each mouthful, you need less. And I've seen it, you know, if I could put a nice aged or grass-fed or both, you know, ribeye in front of you or strip steak, New York cut. Three slices, but you ate three slices and I took it away, you're not going to be pissed off.
Yeah.
Whereas I can put a whole, you know, just, you know, feedlot hunk of meat in front of you, and you can eat a pound and a half of it, and you're still, there's no off switch because you haven't satisfied, you know, yourself at all.
Which was the problem with the no-fat, you know, craze that went on, you know, in the 80s and 90s. That you take the fat is actually the part that satiates you, and so, but it's the same thing, you know, the flavor per calorie.
And
part.
Fat is so important to the development of nerves, and your brain is a lot of nerves.
Yeah,
if people didn't eat fat, we'd still be, you know, we'd still be sharing trees with chimps.
On that note, thanks for doing this with me.
Oh, Jimmy. A pleasure. Thank
it's
you.
Really, really great.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Peter Kaminsky, folks. Always so much fun to talk to him. The thing I love about his stories and his writing is that they bring you into a place and into a deeper experience of the subject matter that he's digging into. His writing gives us the opportunity to consider our relationships to nature, to food, and to each other. If you're a foodie or love the outdoors, in particular fly fishing, I highly recommend checking out his books. I know they're on Amazon, available for download as well. And at your favorite bookstore. He's also one of my favorite people to follow on social media, so check him out there as well. Just to check, a quick reminder that if you haven't rated the podcast yet, I'd really appreciate it if you take a few seconds to just go over and leave us a comment if you like what you're hearing. Here's how you do it. If you're using the iTunes app, tap on the Highway to Health icon. That brings up the episode list. Scroll to the bottom, and you'll see the ratings and reviews. Thanks so much for listening and for supporting this project. If you'd like to support the project, don't forget, it just takes a minute. Just go over to patreon.com/highwaytohealth. And also, I'd love to hear from you. Let me know what you thought of this topic and conversation. I'm always easy to reach by email. It's jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.